Now, our guests this month have never met, but their lives have, through no fault of their own, been turned upside down in strikingly similar ways. And only now, decades later, are those wrongs starting to be made right. The first voice you'll hear, Ken, grew up on a council estate in Scotland in an old coal mining town and became a police officer. This was a time of bitter fights between miners and the government, so to avoid a conflict of interest, his chief inspector diverted him to the countryside.
He deployed me to a place called Brechin, which is absolute heartbeat country. It's all glens, and I had more sheep than people on my beat. It's one of the biggest geographical beats in Scotland, but it's mainly hills and heather, a beautiful part of the world, which I hold very dear to my heart. Even though it was a rural beat, it was quite rough, you know, and I was the only cop for miles. It was 35 minutes before any assistance could get to you if you were in trouble, which didn't happen very often, but when it did, my goodness, it would go horribly pear-shaped. And that's what happened. It was a brawl outside. It was called Flick's Disco, and it had the reputation for having the first laser in Scotland. So busloads would come from miles around to be enthralled with this green laser thing that flashed away. I was the only police officer on duty. You have to just knuckle in and get down to it. But I was thrown through a plate glass window and quite badly injured. So much so that it was a case of kind of missing a wheelchair by about an hour. It was pretty grim. However, the brightness out of that is at the time there was a deal where severely injured police officers could partake of rehabilitation courtesy of the military. And there's a to this day, still there, RAF Headley Court, which is a joint medical centre for the rehabilitation of members of the armed forces. So I ended up there. It was very, very physical. They would be pushing you to do things that a normal citizen would say no, and you couldn't force them to, but you're in a military environment, so it's get on with it, with peer pressure, with people that are in a worse state than you. It's a different type of rehab. Because I was there and in that environment, my confidence in being a police officer had been severely dented. I wasn't sure I wanted to go back into that. And this gave me an opportunity. I thought, well, you know, it's a uniform organization. It's not that different to what I joined at 18. I've only been in the police force 8 or 9 years. What's not to like?
Unlike Ken, Kevin had wanted to be in the Royal Air Force ever since he was a kid.
I remember there was a BBC show called Fighter Pilot, which followed candidates going right from selection at Biggin Hill at the time all the way through their initial officer training and then through into their initial flying training and so on through to being on a fast jet squadron. And, you know, that was it, totally and utterly hooked. And, you know, I joined the Air Cadets.
Yeah, because it's quite a big deal if that really is your goal, to fly, to personally be at the controls. You've got to be thinking about science and eyesight and fitness.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it was, you know, I won a flying scholarship and went and got my private pilot's license when I was 17.
Wow.
And, you know, I was very much focused on joining the RAF and becoming a pilot. Now, unfortunately, my eyesight, I knew at the time, was starting to potentially need glasses in the near future. And back then, it was a case of if you needed glasses, you would not be selected to fly. Yeah. If you were already flying and you needed glasses, that was fine. But they wouldn't take you on from day one needing glasses. So it came to the choice of do I go to university, get a degree, and then go into the RAF afterwards. At the time, my head said, no, your eyesight's not going to be good enough. Go straight for the RAF.
So all your eggs were in that basket.
They were, very much so. After finishing the initial officer training, the first thing you do is you go off to your basic flying training. For myself, that was in Linton-on-Ouse in Yorkshire. It was high pressure. You were starting to fly, and you were flying a jet straight away. So you had a few weeks of ground school training where you learned about the aircraft and so on, and the basics of aerodynamics and flight theory and so on. And then you did some simulator work, but then very soon you started strapping yourself into a small two-seat jet with an instructor and starting your lessons.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes and no. You had so much to focus on. Not only the actual physical demands of flying, which are quite high in a fast jet aircraft, the coordination that's required, the mental gymnastics that are required for navigating, communicating with people on the ground, communicating with other people in the air. It is no wonder that so few people get through there. It is high intensity, and it was quite clear I didn't have the capacity to be both coordinated at the controls of the aircraft and maintain all the other things that were required.
That must have been difficult.
It was. You've got to remember this was back in 1987, 88. So this was before GPS and so on. So a lot of aircraft in the RAF still had navigators, that second person who was reading the map, planning the trips, planning the fuel, monitoring the fuel. So it was still a high demand activity, but it was divorced from perhaps the physical coordination that was required at the same time. So that I did excel at. So, my role was as an air interceptor, and it was very much picking up an enemy aircraft, calculating the best way to get into a position behind that aircraft to launch your missiles, and then get close enough if the missiles hadn't worked for your pilot to take over and use the guns. So, that was what we were there for. We were there training for that role.
What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was so focused on the career, actually, I didn't have a great deal of personal life. There was just so intense in the training, I just didn't consider a personal life. But as I was progressing through that and I was becoming more familiar with the role, that capacity came along. And so, we had events in the mess and we met people, and obviously we went out on the town in Dundee and so on. And I actually met my wife, fairly whirlwind romance, all seemed to work very well. And so we got married. I can't remember how old I was now, 23, 24, something like that. It was only after a number of years that I realized that I wasn't getting something from the relationship that I knew was important. And I knew as well, I wasn't giving her what was important for her health and happiness and well-being.
Did you know what that was?
Not really. We had a daughter that, again, all seemed to help bond the family together. But after a while, again, those feelings of something wasn't right. I wasn't satisfied in the relationship in a way that my head was telling me you should be in a relationship. It was almost one of those we need to sit down and have a talk type moments, and she said, yes, I've got something to say as well. And so I said, okay, after you. And she said, oh, I'm pregnant again. And so I just shut down and said, oh, no, okay, well then that's great. What I had to say doesn't matter then. And so I tried very hard to make it work. I had one daughter and there was another child on the way. So it had to work. That's what I was telling myself. I had to make it work. But as time moved on, it became very clear that as much as I cared for her, I couldn't be the husband that she deserved, both in that relationship sense and in a physical sense. And so that came to a head shortly after the birth of our second child. And we separated. And initially, she didn't know why, other than I'd said, it just isn't working, because I had this massive fear that if she knew that it was because I was having feelings of being gay, that she would report me to the RAF. And at that time, it was very much a case of, that's it, you're out.
That's right. In the 1980s and 90s, it was still illegal to be gay in Britain's military. Homosexuality had been decriminalised in England and Wales in 1967. In Scotland, that change happened later, in 1981. But all the way through the 20th century, if you served in the armed forces, you could lose your job, your medals, and your pension just for being gay.
I was married at the time, and I should have twigged because I kind of fancied the best man when I fancied my wife. You know, the writing was very much on the wall there. And Kevin Porter, if you're listening to this, I apologise. But the law had just changed in Scotland.
Were you in love with your wife?
Yes. Yes, very much so. We were only married 3 years. I think she knew before I did. My wife was very much into amateur dramatics. And I remember I used to go and have to attend these blasted things in the local little village hall every Christmas, you know, and sit there as a local copper giving support to the community, thinking, what am I doing here? But inside me, recognizing that some of the men on stage, I found their effervescence, their sheer joy of life, their campness, maybe, very attractive, and I couldn't work out why. And this was a time when, because I was so-called pretty police, I'd be put into public toilets in plain clothes to try and entrap people in public toilets. That's what it was like then. And I became friends with these guys and girls and found a company, a breath of fresh air. And it started to awaken something inside me that I didn't even realize at the time I'd suppressed. There was no support. There's no such thing as gay chat lines or helplines or anything like that. There was nothing. There was nothing at that time. You just had to get on with it. And the macho side in me took over. It just said, this is not happening. Talk about coming from the frying pan into the fire. It had just been made legal in Scotland, and I thought, no, I'm not having any of that. And I then joined the military, the RAF, where it was wholly illegal. So I, in a way, had chosen a lifestyle that would suppress what I felt was something wrong inside me, a defect in me.
Where did you get posted?
Most people that join the RAF police then join the civilian police, or, you know, there's a natural progression to that. I did it the other way about. So I came to the RAF with a huge skill set that they deeply wanted. So I never saw an aircraft, never got the sniff of an aeroplane. I was sent straight to Strike Command Headquarters at RAF High Wycombe. It's the centre for commanding United Kingdom Air Forces, and it's where the Commander-in-Chief of United Kingdom Air Forces to this day will be based. And we were part of a very small unit that was dedicated to policing that. We were live armed, and we would protect very, very senior officers 24 hours a day.
So wherever they were?
Wherever they were. So if they were travelling off-site to go home, we would be with them in their home. We would police outside that home.
And then in the 80s as well, presumably there was a threat of IRA terrorism towards those people.
This was also a time of Greenham Common, which wasn't that very far away from High Wycombe.
That was the anti-nuclear protest, right?
Yeah, ban the bomb, that sort of thing, CND.
And so that's a split-second decision, isn't it? Has this guy just hit me with an egg, or have they hit me with a grenade?
Yeah, well, you're trained. You were given two things to shout. You know, RAF police, stop or I fire. And if they came towards you, you drew your weapon and you would arm it. That's a live round going into the weapon. And scream again, live armed RAF police, stop or I fire. And if they continued, you were supposed to open fire.
Sounds like you must have been pretty good at your job to be trusted with such a senior position going straight into the RAF.
Well, with some modesty, yes, I was. I was humbly given the baton of honour as best RAF police officer of that intake. And when I was deployed to RAF High Wycombe after 2 odd years there, I was given the Commander-in-Chief of United Kingdom Air Force's personal commendation for services to the Air Force, which was quite a thing.
So homosexuality was illegal in the RAF. You had these growing feelings towards other men. You realised you found men attractive. How did you process that?
Well, it was difficult because there would be random searches. You know, you had a room to yourself, but there would be a random search of your room just to check for anything that was contrary to military law. And bear in mind, I was occasionally the one that had to do these searches. So, you know, who pleases the police? Yeah, I was stuck in this situation where my job was to stop people doing what a little bit of me wanted to do.
Yeah. And to be clear, this era could have been a copy of the Gay Times, right? Could have been a book by absolutely. Joe Orton yeah. might have raised suspicion.
Yeah, if they had an inkling, they would follow you. So they would watch where you want. They would put officers into the very few gay pubs that were available at the time just to see who was going in. You were perceived to be a risk to national security. Homosexuality was seen as an in for reds under the beds or whatever you want to call it.
Around the same time, Martin was training at Bassingbourne as an infantry soldier. He was dyslexic. He'd left school with just one GCSE in music and signed up to the army at the age of 18 when he was still coming to terms with his sexuality.
We'd gone to Germany for a break and it was my first introduction to brothels. All of my friends were kind of like, oh, it's your birthday. So we're all clubbing together and we're going to stick you in this brothel and you're going to have a marvellous time and you're 18. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, what's going on here? So you sort of go along with it. And they kicked me into this brothel and there was this great big German lady. I was kind of like, oh my God, I got my Deutschmarks out and I gave her another 50 and just said, you sit there for 20 minutes and, you know, we'll get through this. Quite deceitful, really. But after about 20 minutes, I appeared and of course everyone's like, yeah. You know, it just gets buried again. You're one of the boys again. I did a tour of Northern Ireland as well. And we went to Cyprus for a while. Came back and I'd injured my knee. And I was having some rehab. We got talking to this guy. We were talking about music. And it turns out that this guy was a musician within the army. So I said, oh, that's really interesting. How does that happen? What happens? And he's like, have you got any musical experience? So I said, yeah, I've got grade 5. And he said, whoa, okay, listen, can I tell the bandmaster? So I said, well, yeah, of course you can. So I hadn't played for a couple of years at that point, and suddenly I was called to the bandmaster's office, and he said to me, play something for me. And I tried to play some bits and bobs. I hadn't played for a while. Do some scales and stuff like that. He said to me, well, do you know what? This is quite good. We could make you a tradesman at this point. I was sort of sitting in a barrack room with 8 men one day, and then obviously overnight I'd auditioned, and the bandmaster was like, you're coming tomorrow. And within 3 days they said, well, we're off on tour. We're going to go on tour of Europe.
Public shows.
Doing public shows, public concerts, just raising the profile of the regiment. I'd become more in touch with myself and who I was and what I was. I remember we had a weekend's leave. It was about 3 months into this course, and I thought I'm going to try a gay pub. Sort of walked around the block about 15 times before I plucked up the courage to go in. And lo and behold, there's 2 other musicians sitting in the corner. And I was kind of like, what are you doing here? And they're kind of like, probably the same as what you're doing here.
2 musicians from your course?
Yeah, from my course. That really opened my eyes at that point, and I was kind of thinking, wow. One side of me was really, really frightened and really, really scared because I all of a sudden I'd become exposed.
You've just been outed.
Yeah. But the other side of me was kind of like, well, hang on a minute, you're not on your own.
And did you end up in a relationship with another man?
I did. I met somebody. He was a civvy. He's kind of like, so come on, I know you're not a builder. What do you do for a living? So I said, oh, shh. I'm in the army. And of course he was like, whoa, really? And that all became very exciting.
Did he know that it was illegal?
Yeah, he knew. And I was like, no, don't come to the camp. Do not come to the camp under any circumstances. I will always come and see you. And I sort of used to spend my weekends at his place and obviously become more and more and more exposed to gay life.
Meanwhile, Kevin, now separated from his wife, had met someone too. Now based up at RAF Kinloss, one of the few ways he could make contact with other gay men was via a premium rate gay chat line.
The guy that I started seeing lived in Worcester. So it was a nice long distance relationship. So it was very much a case of, yeah, that's far enough. I'm pretty sure there's unlikely to be someone who will accidentally see me going into a bar or meeting up with him.
But it did mean that you could only see each other, really, when you're on R&R, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's it. So I had to take leave. I took as many long weekends as I could, and it would be either a train or I had a motorcycle. So you had those brief moments that we met up with each other for a long weekend. And then, of course, there's that whole going back to work afterwards and the usual natural curiosity from people. Oh, how was your weekend? What did you do? And that total panic, having to think, okay, I've got to remember not to say he, I've got to say she, and that switching of pronouns, or just being completely gender neutral in everything you were trying to talk about for fear of giving the game away.
On his weekends in London, Ken was plucking up the courage to go into a gay bar.
I didn't have much confidence on the gay scene to speak to anybody. But I saw someone sat at the bar with lime green hair, wearing an old RAF bloomer jacket, as they used to call it, sort of a fighter jacket. Very effervescent, having a great time, and thought, that looks like an interesting guy. He was living in London. He and I hit it off big time. I fell in love with him. And he was obviously going to stay in London. And because I was Mr. Goody Two-Shoes in the military, I was about to be promoted. I mean, significant promotion. I was being offered a commission, so an officer rank. But it meant, after significant training, being deployed probably to Germany, which was quite a big base at the time. You had to be very careful if at the time there's no email or anything like that, you know, it's not even yet mobile phones. So we write to each other, but his letters had to come through the central station post office. If he sent a parcel, on one occasion he sent a I think it was a Valentine's Day gift of a, there was a craze for teddy bears in tins and metal cans. You send a huge teddy bear in a big metal can. It went to the central post office at High Wycombe and created a security alert because they couldn't work out what was this organic substance in a metal box, you know. So you can imagine if he had signed it from Colin, all hell would have let loose. But he used a nickname, so people just thought, oh, his girlfriend sent him a teddy bear. But that was a close shave. That could have had serious repercussions.
And up in Kinloss for Kevin, those repercussions were about to get very real.
We actually joined a motorcycle club, gay motorcycle club. It was in the good old days where you actually had a membership card, and I foolishly had that card in my wallet and nice. Lost that wallet, which somebody found and handed in to the RAF police.
And was there any cloak and dagger about the name of the motorcycle club?
I mean, it had Gay Bikers Motorcycle Club on. So it was obvious what it was, and my name and signature were on the back of it. Stupid, really. Why did I even have it in the wallet? But that's where it was. And I was returning from a training flight, and we landed, and the wing commander, boss of the squadron, met the aircraft, which in itself is a fairly unusual thing to happen. And he comes on board as I'm packing away my kit after the flight, and he just says, just leave that and come with me. I think I knew straight away what it was, and you know, he drove me to the RAF police station on the camp, and I was arrested and cautioned. I remember they passed the membership card across the desk to me, and the police officer who was in questioning me said, is this your membership card? And I sort of looked at it and said, well, it's got my name on the back, hasn't it? So it's a very good chance it is. And then there started the questions about, are you gay? Are you a homosexual? Are you practicing? Do you know any other homosexuals on the camp? So
wow.
they were interested in knowing if I knew of any other network of gays on the site. Certainly there was no indication from any of the RAF leadership that there was any way it would mean anything other than a discharge. So, you know, we finished the interview. I was immediately suspended. So I went back to my room in the officer's mess. I started the process of coming out.
In Ken's case, however, he made the decision to tell his superiors himself.
Something has to give, and it's not going to be the relationship. So it's got to be the job I loved, the job I was proud to do, the job I was good at, but it didn't seem to want me or my lifestyle. Time to go.
How did you approach that?
I went to the station medical officer, doctor, and admitted everything. But I said during the interview, I said, I fear I'm going to do something stupid. And he thought I was going to top myself.
Yeah.
I was actually talking about going AWOL, you know, about deserting. And it escalated. Before I knew it, I was in front of the station commander, the doctor, and this station warrant officer, a most formidable character. He's a sort of sergeant major of the RAF station. Very aggressive. We are in the station commander's office where a few months ago, in January, I'd been there to be presented by Air Officer Commanding, one of the biggest awards you could be given in civil times in the military. And here I am back, and I remember saying, you don't see the same confident corporal right in front of you as was here in January, sir. The station commander said, we're going to have to let you go. I don't understand why I'm doing this. I'm just losing a good man. I don't understand why I'm forced to do this.
That must have in itself been a bit of a weight off your shoulders.
It was a very emotional occasion. I think everybody in that room was pretty emotional. He said, which was astonishing at the time, he said, I just want you to go back to your partner and we will contact you when we're ready to let you go. But in the meantime, you will have to clear out your rooms and take your personal stuff away. And he looked at the station warrant officer and said, I do not want to hear that this man has been bullied in any way. I do not want anything to happen to him, from him leaving this room to coming back in here to hand over his warrant card and leave the service. And this hard, hard man with years in the military looked up and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, sir, there will be no repercussions. Nothing will happen because my son's gay. And you could have heard a pin drop when he said that.
Wow.
That will stay with me for as long as I'm on this planet. I'll never forget that moment.
Still to come, what happened when Martin, at a much more junior rank, came out to his superiors? That's next. After this.
Now, there comes a particular point where this thing then overtakes me. I just remember traveling back to the school on the Sunday night on the train and thinking, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this at the weekend. And I can't parade on Monday morning like nothing's happening.
Because you're playing two different characters.
Yeah, yeah. And that really frightened me because for the first time I kind of realised that you're two different people and this is not going to end well.
And neither of them's honest, really.
No.
Are they? That's the thing. You know, you say you found yourself at the weekend, which I totally understand, you know, from a position of feeling a personal liberation. But at the same time, you can't really be honest about what you do for a living there. And that's what you're doing 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And of course, at the school, you can't talk about who you're in love with.
No. I just remember waking up this morning, and there's a kind of chain of command that you go through when you want to see somebody or you've got a problem or whatever. And I went to see my section commander, and I said, listen, I really need to see the boss this morning. And he's like, what do you mean you need to see the boss? Why? What's wrong? So I said, I can't tell you, it's personal. And he's like, personal? There's no such thing as personal in the army. What's the matter with you? Tell me and I will tell everybody else. So I said, I just can't. So he was kind of like, do you need to see the doctor? So I said, no, I need to see the boss. I want to speak to the boss.
And who is this boss?
He was a lieutenant colonel. He was the commandant of the School of Music. He sits on the higher echelons of the military at the HQ and all that kind of stuff.
But not the kind of guy you speak to very regularly.
No,
in your position.
No. In fact, if he's coming down the road, you'd probably cross the road and walk the other way. So obviously, you get your best kit on and off you go. And I was just thinking, oh my God, it's shit or bust now. It's got to happen. You've got to do it. And I was just shitting myself. And we got there, and the sergeant major said to me, what are you here for? So I said, I really need to see the commandant. I've got a personal issue. So he's like, okay, they go the other way first, don't they? They go, so you got somewhere pregnant? I was like, no. He's like, what? And I said, I'd really like to discuss it with the commandant. At that time in the military, it just didn't happen like this. He's kind of, you tell me. And before I knew what was what, it was out. So I said to him, look, I'm gay. And he just, I remember his eyes going like that. It was just like, I beg your pardon. I said, yes, sir, I'm gay. I need to see the commandant. Yes, you fucking do. And I was like, ooh, now I know that it's happening. So in I goes to see the commandant. Left, right, and all this kind of stuff. And halt in front of him, salute him. And he's sitting there with his cap on. And he says to me, yeah, what's wrong? What's the problem? So I said to him, look, sir, there's no other way to dress this up. I've got to tell you, I'm gay. And he looked at me and he just sort of took his hat off and he put it in his in tray and he said to me, listen, young man, I really want you to think about what you're saying. I'm going to give you 5 minutes to turn around and go to the other side of that door and think about what's happening here. Now, I didn't have a clue what he was talking about, to be honest. But when I reflect on that, what a gentleman, what a nice man. He's actually saying to me, do you realise you're chucking your career away here?
Yeah, do you know what the consequences are?
Yeah.
And he's also saying, look, of course there are gay people here. We don't talk about it because we're not allowed to have you here.
Yeah.
So I'll just pretend I haven't heard that, isn't yeah. he? He's giving you that opportunity.
But of course, I go outside for 5 minutes. The sergeant major follows me out. He's not letting anything go at all. He's in my face. He's, you fucking get back in there and you make sure you tell him you don't change your mind. You're out of this army. We've got no space in this man's army for any pufters and all the rest of it. Well, it's done now, isn't it? So I might as well just carry on. So in I go. And he said to me, I'm really sorry to hear this. You're a really promising musician. We really, really like what you do. You're a great sportsman. But my hands are really tired at this point. You know, I have to place you under close arrest. You will be investigated by the SIB. We don't have any facilities to detain you here at the school. So you will be transported to Hounslow Barracks, where the Welsh Guards are. And you'll be held in the guard room there until decisions are made. And I just knew that meant hell because I'm now back into the army environment, the Welsh Guards. So right. The guard room is like it's their on-site prison that's run by regimental police officers that are pulled from the regiment, ex-boxers and all this kind of stuff.
I mean, this is where you'd go, presumably, if you'd smuggled in drugs or cut someone's face, right?
Yeah, fighting, anything like that. Anything. This is where you'd go. And they do this thing called beasting. So you kind of you wear this kind of really shiny helmet. You carry shells, big shells on your shoulder. You don't have any laces in your boots, and you wear green overalls all the time. And you're marched to doubled to meals, and then marched back, and just taken PT, cleaning, hours and hours and hours. And then when 10 o'clock comes and they're locking you in, you're so grateful because you just collapse. But then again, the system starts all over again at 6 o'clock in the morning with inspections and drilling and bullying and all this kind of stuff that goes on.
Ken didn't face an ordeal like that. He was now living in Balham with his partner, Colin. But it wasn't over for him either.
They looked at my record, they looked at my history, they looked at the awards and said, we don't believe you. They didn't believe I was gay. So they started an investigation. I had to prove the nonsense, the bizarreness of it. There's me for years denying everything and hiding everything. I now had to prove to the special branch of the military police that I was gay, having spent years denying it.
What possible reason would you have for saying that you were in that environment?
Yeah, when you sign up for a period of time, and it was 3 years, 6 years, 9 years, and I'd signed up for 9 years.
So you're trying to get yourself off.
And there was a big thing then of people, it's called PVR, Purchase Voluntary Redundancy, where you could buy yourself out. But they were so short of military personnel, and the conditions at times were less than ideal. You know, they even to this day, living conditions in military bases can be pretty grim. So they thought that I, like many, were trying to find a way out of getting out without paying. We had a knock on the, well, I had a knock on the door, Colin was working, and here were these two plainclothes military police officers with a warrant to say we're here to interview you. Colin is where he was awaiting in a restaurant around the corner, and he got dragged out of the restaurant, a civilian, dragged out of the restaurant by plainclothes military police to answer questions. And it would be things like, describe what you do in bed together. You know, the audacity of that. How bloody dare they? We had to go through that. There was a nonsense and a glitch in the law at the time that if you were in a shared accommodation, so we were in a room of three other rooms with other people, if you're in shared accommodation as a gay couple, you had to have a bolt or a lock on the inside of your bedroom door for fear of offending public decency, should a flatmate inadvertently walk in on you. That was the audacity of people with clipboards telling you how to live your life. How bloody dare they? But that's what we went through.
How was your record marked in the end when you were discharged?
It was discharged due to circumstances beyond his control. Well, if ever there was a truer statement, it was that. But all my colleagues couldn't understand what happened. I was a golden boy. You know, I was the one that was destined for great things. And suddenly disappeared. They weren't allowed to contact you. They weren't allowed any communication with you whatsoever. And to this day, there will be people I served with that won't have a clue what happened to me. People that I sat and ate with, that we'd clean the weapons with, that we'd stand in howling gales together, protecting things with, would have no idea why I suddenly disappeared off the face of the earth.
So you were there one day and then you were gone?
Gone, yeah. Ripped away from something that was such a huge part of your life that you're so proud of, that suddenly didn't want you anymore. You weren't good enough and you were so embarrassing, you had to be smuggled out the back door and hidden away and, yeah, forgotten about.
Was there any element of self-loathing as well? You'd made the decision to join the RAF police in the first place, that you thought you could somehow beat the system. Did you blame yourself at all rather than the institution?
Yes, I did at the time. I think that's why they were so lenient on me, because I stated that I didn't want anything to reflect onto the Air Force. I didn't want to bring any shame onto the Air Force. I just wanted the matter dealt with quietly.
So I was there for a couple of days, and what they decided to do then was for some strange reason, they sort of said, listen, we need to check this out. We're not quite sure whether you're swinging the lead or not. So what we're going to do is we're going to send you to a psychiatric hospital at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Woolwich. It's a locked psychiatric unit. I'm thinking, well, it's got to be better than here. I arrived there, and luckily, you know, a couple of the nurses that were there and sort of said, look, forget all this nonsense. Okay, just try and calm down. The doctor will see you tomorrow. Can we do anything to help you? And I was like, well, no, not really. I just need to chill out a bit. And they're like, yeah, fine. We get it.
What year was this?
This was 1992.
I mean, what you're describing is kind of like what you would have expected in 1962.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was the same right the way up to 2000. So I went in front of the commanding officer again, and he said to me, look, will you accept my award or will you go to court martial? And that's a whole another load of crap you don't really want to get involved in. So I said to him, no, I accept your award, sir, expecting him to say, there's the door, goodbye. And he said to me, well, we're going to give you 48 days close custody, and you'll be transferred to the Military Corrective Training Center.
Prison,
Colchester. Now that, I just, my heart sank. I just thought, oh my God, what? Why? What? You know, I'd kind of opened up. I'd been truthful for once in my life. And now there was a price to pay. And believe you me, you know, I thought I'd understood how evil and twisted and bitter the military could be up until that point, until I got there. And I was separated. I was in a single cell on my own. I wasn't allowed to mingle with the other prisoners. I was marched separately to meals. It's built to be totally overwhelming to all of your senses. It's designed to disorientate you. It's designed to humiliate you. And these guys that are in there, not the soldiers under sentence, these blue caps, these prison officers, if you like, they're just evil people. And I'm
which
sure...
makes sense if the point is to reintegrate you into the armed forces, doesn't it? Like, actually, if the point is you've got involved in a fight or you've done something, you know, that antagonizes the enemy and you fuck something up,
yeah,
but we're going to punish you and then you're going to come back, it sort of makes sense. But in your case, as you said, you'd been honest and you wanted out. It's not like they were going to reintegrate you afterwards. It was just a humiliation, right?
Yeah, it's total humiliation. I think because of my basic military training, that got me through that. And then I left there and I was in a god-awful state, really.
How did you feel?
Relieved that I was out of that environment. I felt... I'd let myself down in a massive way. I'd lost my career.
And you're how old now at this point?
18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25.
Yeah. It's scary.
Yeah.
The matter wasn't over for Kevin either. Having been outed, then ousted from the job he'd wanted since he was a child, he turned to legal action.
I wanted to stay in. That was really what I was fighting for, was the chance to stay in. It took 13 months before eventually I exhausted all the avenues I could to try and prevent me being thrown out. And then September 95, I was actually administratively discharged. That's where things moved on into pursuing things through the courts and, you know, ultimately ending up in the European Court of Human Rights. We were arguing that it was that breach of human rights to discriminate someone based on their sexuality for their employment and their fitness to serve the country.
Had you been advised that you were going to win, though? Did you think you were going to win?
The lawyers were, I think, fairly blunt and honest about it and said, you know, this will be a difficult case to win. You will have the weight of the UK government and the Ministry of Defence going up against it, arguing you know what the regulations were, and so on and so on and so on. So this was in 2002 when they actually ruled on my case. By then, the UK armed forces had already legalised being gay within the armed forces in January 2000. So, you know, by then they had effectively already admitted that there was no bar to LGBT personnel serving in the armed forces.
But you're only 35 at that point. So
yeah.
Did you think, well, I'll try and go back? Would you have wanted to have gone back?
I'd already, at that point, retrained and qualified as an accountant. I had moved on. The life I had wasn't quite the one I had pictured, but I had moved on. It was challenging leading up to that point financially because I was still learning. I was only able to take relatively junior roles in accountancy because, you know, I was the new boy. You know, it took a long while to make up the financial deficit. So things were certainly tough for a while. When the court case was eventually decided, yes, there was a financial settlement as a result of that. It was nothing like what the legal team had suggested might possibly be available. they had numbers that valued my pension loss alone in the millions.
How much did you get?
It was about 115,000, I think it was. So, you know, it was enough to clear the significant debts that I had and to sort me out on an even keel.
But that wasn't the end of it. After Kevin had put his head above the parapet at the European courts, there followed a two-page expose in a Sunday tabloid.
My ex-wife sold her story, and it was full of how this evil RAF person had abandoned her and the children and so on. And it wasn't the friendliest of stories. And I remember I drove to work and I sat in the office car park for about an hour in my car, just shaking in my car, until eventually I thought, I've got to go in at some point, even if it's just to get my P45. And so I went in, and my boss was in, and I went in to see her, and I said, look, I've got something that I need to tell you. And I explained, you know, this story has appeared in the Mail on Sunday. You may have seen it. And she actually did get the Mail on Sunday, but it was very much a non-event.
But it triggered you. You were having the thought that you could get fired from your current civilian job in 2002 because the newspaper's written that you're gay, basically. Yep.
And, you know, I was proven completely and utterly wrong. There were no issues at all at work. In fact, it helped me become liberated and that much more active in the support of the inclusion and diversity message that the company was given. You know, I will stand up and give inclusion and diversity messages all day long now at my place of work. And, you know, I've been recognised for that.
Even though you had that judgment from the court, and even though it was so long ago, do you sometimes still feel that injustice that you were really good at your job and you had to stop doing your job for nothing to do with your job? And actually nothing to do with the law, just the law of the institution you happen to work for.
Definitely. I've not been properly recompensed for what was taken from me. There have been many times over the years where I have thought, oh, I really miss the Air Force. I miss the camaraderie, the atmosphere of being on a squadron. I never met my full potential in the RAF because I was always distracted by something else. I was living in fear. I was never able to be my true self. It's a high demand environment. You can't afford to be distracted in any way, shape or form. You need your full capacity to be a good soldier, sailor, airman. I always had some of that capacity elsewhere because I was hiding myself. One of the few people I still have occasional contact with from my RAF days, he used to be an engineering officer who was in the room next door to me at Kinloss. I think he was assistant chief of the defence staff or something along those lines, the last time I saw him. And I did jokingly say to him, you do realise you've got my job. That could have been me. And part of me thinks, you know, that could have been me. If I'd have been able to be my true self.
This Remembrance Sunday, for the first time, Kevin, Ken and Martin will join the march past at the Cenotaph, where an official wreath will be laid representing the thousands of veterans forced out for being LGBT. These days, Martin is a trained mental health practitioner with the NHS. Ken and his partner Colin now run a venue in Soho.
I turned 60 this year. Colin and I inherited Phoenix Arts Club. We had no notion of what it was to run a pub.
What do you think now when you see those young LGBTQ plus patrons? Do you think, God, they've got an opportunity I never had? Do you feel jealous?
No, not at all. I look at it the other way. I think that's the reason I joined the Air Force. That's the type of world I wanted to protect. That's the type of society that you wear a uniform for. The military should reflect the society it defends, and that is why I am still proud to say I served in the RAF.